You're listening to Rendezvous with the Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to Rendezvous with the Writer, where readers and writers meet.
And story is everything.
We're your hosts tonight, Jim and Bobby Bell.
And thank you for once again joining us. If you've been listening regularly weekly or you're joining us for the first time, thank you so much for being with us. We really appreciate the opportunity to bring an author and his or her work to you. It's just great fun for us, a privilege for us. And so thank you for riding along with us. Who was that music by?
That's a Hot Texas swing band.
Yeah.
Alex Dormont, yeah. Our buddy.
We thank them for providing them opening and closing music. And if you are if you love swing music, you need to check out the Hot Texas Swing Band. So, Jim, who's our guest tonight?
Our special guest tonight is Linda Strader.
Yes.
Welcome.
And she's the author of, you want to hold up the book?
Oh.
Yeah.
Summers of Fire.
Well, here, we'll get yeah, Jim's getting his first chance to hold up a book in the camera. There we go. Yeah. Summers of Fire, a memoir of adventure, love, and courage. And our guest, Linda Strader, has just joined us on camera. And she's written a second book we're going to talk about a little bit later called Uprooted. But Linda, the opening page of Uprooted has some wonderful testimonials about Summer of Fire. And a couple of them I felt were better words than I would have to describe the book. If I can find the page right at the beginning, this is a review that was in Green Valley News by Karen Wellenga. Strader's writing is insightfully descriptive, from nature's wonders and brutality to times when she survived only on sheer willpower. And this is so very true. Truly pushing herself physically to the brink and the rewards she found working in the great Western outdoors. This well-written memoir will have readers caught up in the adventurous twists and turns to the very end. And I would say that is exactly a fabulous description of this book. Do you want to introduce Linda?
I have a little bio here, now that you ask. Linda is originally from Syracuse, New York. She moved to Prescott, Arizona with her family in 1972. In 1976, she became one of the first women hired on a U.S. Forest Service fire crew. Linda holds 2 degrees, a Bachelor of Landscape Architecture and a Master's in Planning from the University of Arizona. In addition to writing, she is a landscape architect, certified arborist, and a watercolor artist. She currently lives in the same area where her Forest Service career began. Yes. Welcome, Linda.
Welcome, Linda.
Hello. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I know you waited a long time. I think we originally set this up last fall, and then we had to delay it once. And we're just delighted that you're here with us. Yeah. Do you want to just start off by sharing a little bit more about yourself with our watchers and listeners?
Well, Jim covered it pretty well. I wear a number of hats. You know, I'm a landscape architect and certified arborist, and I have a small business in landscape design. Mm-hmm. I'm also a watercolor artist, as well as a published author. And people say, well, so where do you find time to do anything else?
There you go.
Yeah.
But I do.
When did you start writing?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that.
Sure. When did you start writing?
I started writing beyond, you know, term papers for college and mm-hmm. things like that. Probably about 2010. It was during a time in my life where I was going through a lot. I got a divorce, as many people do. I lost my job and my mom passed away, all very close together. And I was looking for work. It was during when the economy collapsed in 2008, and I was struggling with just finding ways to keep myself busy. And it occurred to me, you know, to maybe jot down some of the memories of my past experiences on a fire crew. I had a lot of adventures, and I thought, you know, this would be something to pass some time. So that's what got me started, was just trying to jot down memories.
That's good.
Do you have a question?
Well, I will say, what inspired you actually to write the memoir?
Well, you know, so after I started out just writing down, you know, memories, and I tried to make it a little bit of a story, because I did write a very short story for one of my college English classes about my first fire, and the professor thought that it was so good that he wanted to keep it to share for other classes to show an example. And that's back when I had no computers or anything, so it was typed, and I just handed it to him and said, sure, you can have it. So I didn't keep it, and I thought, well, maybe I can recreate that. And then I started adding more, and I ended up with about 90 pages, and it wasn't until I shared those 90 pages with friends that they said, you know, you should try to expand this. So I thought, well, what else have I got to do? I'm still looking for work. So I added like 400 more pages. Wow. And then I thought, oh, this kind of looks like a book, which was not my intent, but all of a sudden I had one.
You are credited with being one of the very first women that was fighting fires through the Forest Service back in 1972. In 76. That's right. 72 was that move. In 76, did you know at the time that you were such a pioneer and you were doing something that really no other women had done?
Well, you know, I had no idea. I was 20, naive, and I just thought, I guess no other women are interested. You know, that's why they weren't. It didn't occur to me that the reason that they weren't there is that they weren't welcome. And the Forest Service, I mean, the Equal Employment Opportunity Act passed in 72, and you know, the Forest Service was, you know, they were supposed to be on board with hiring minorities, including women, and they were very resistant to that. So while there were a few women hired in 75, it still was rare, and they had a lot of pressure in 76 to start bringing women in. And I didn't know this. This is not something I found out until later. And when I realized, it kind of sunk in. It's like, oh, no wonder I had such a hard time. It was just, I didn't know what the problem was, other than, you know, I was met with resistance. And the further I went in my career, the more serious it got, you know, when I started being discriminated against. And then I realized, you know, this is not fun and games. I mean, this is my career here. And there were certain men that were bound and determined not to let me continue.
We did notice in the book one time you did not receive a job offer from a really seemed like a great, great job, but right down your alley. So that had to be very disappointing when somebody that knew nothing about forestry got the job.
Yeah.
We're going to understand.
You, you really loved what you were doing. It's obvious in the book. You loved what you were doing, and you wanted to be a hotshot initially, or at some point you realized that that was kind of the thing. That was what you were aiming for. Yes.
Yes. And the main reason I think that I wanted it is that, first of all, they went to more fires and I liked fighting fires. And it was considered very prestigious. And I thought, well, I can do this. And I wanted that, you know, that prestige. I didn't at first, but eventually I did. Mm-hmm. And it was very elusive. That was a very difficult position to get into.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm a little bit curious, what made you think you wanted to fight fires? Was this something you thought about off and on over the years, or did it just come to you one day, hey, this is it?
Well, you know, so I really struggled when I graduated from high school and I was trying to find work. I really struggled with what I wanted to do. But I knew what I didn't want to do. I didn't want to be a secretary. I didn't want to work in retail. Yeah. I didn't want to answer phones. I mean, all of that stuff just bored me to death. And I thought, that's just, it's not me. And I did all of those things when I had to, but I hated every minute of it. And so I didn't know what it was that I was looking for until I accepted that position on a fire crew. I'd already had some experience with the Forest Service working in an office. And I knew, I was exposed to firefighting and the challenges and the excitement of fires. And I thought, wow, you know, that would be a really an amazing job. And I never gave it a second thought that I couldn't do it. I figured I could. Mm-hmm. You know, you're 20, you can do anything.
Yeah, you can do anything.
You know, it was, I just thought, you know, I want to try this. And after my first fire, which is only 2 weeks into my new job, I knew I'd found what I wanted to do. You either liked it or you hated it. And I really liked it, even though obviously it's extremely strenuous. And I had blisters where I didn't know you'd get blisters, and my hands were bleeding from using a hand tool all day, and smoke inhalation and exhaustion and all of that. And I didn't care. I just felt
you loved it.
A tremendous sense of pride that I did.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I think part of the pleasure of reading the book is you don't romanticize the tough physical challenges. You give it to us straight. So if we have watched some movies, or we've been watching this show Fire Country or what all, and we think that we have a sense of what you are all doing when you battle a wildfire, you give it to us. Like you just said, blisters, and you don't hold anything back. And I, as a reader, really appreciated that. I felt like I was right there with that tool, that Pulaski, is that how you say it? The Pulaski tool? And
Pulaski.
Yeah. And then you learn how to use a chainsaw. Oh my gosh. And it becomes second nature to you, you know?
Yeah. So, you know, when I, after my first summer, I went out and bought my own chainsaw. So, you know, so that's how I was really, you know, fascinated with all of the tools of the trade. You know, I wanted to learn how to use them all.
Yeah.
You know, it looked like you had to reapply every year, though, for the job. There's no guarantee.
Guarantees. And you never knew where you were going to go, which was part of the excitement. I mean, the first three summers I did stay in the same place and I was happy to, but then I didn't get re-upped in my fourth summer. And so I ended up in Flagstaff. And to me, it was like, well, okay, so I didn't get the one that I thought I was going to get, but this will be okay. I'll make it work. And it was kind of exciting to get offers. Because back then, now they don't give you more than one offer; you get one. But back then, I'd hang on because I never knew when another one might come in that might be someplace else I would want to go.
So, it was summer.
It was kind of.
Yeah, and summers, we have that right in the title. So you're working, like, from what month to what month, generally speaking, was your term?
I would say it varied every year, but it's usually about late March, April, through September, October. Mm-hmm. And it did depend on how much rainfall they got, because obviously if the fire danger, if the forest was very wet, we'd get laid off early. If they had extra money, they would hire us early so we could get project work done. In 77, I was hired in March. So, you know, it varied. Of course, I always wanted the longest time period possible, but I never knew, you know, what it was going to be.
How did your family feel about this line of work for you?
Well, so my mom said, I'll worry about you, but I want you to do what you want to do.
Yeah.
And my dad said, you don't belong in that job. That's a man's job.
Yep.
My younger sister was too young to care, I think. And my older sister couldn't understand why I didn't just go get a real job. It was hard. And so what it came down to is I'm going to do what I want to do regardless of what you think.
Oh, my goodness.
It's my life.
Yeah.
What? What happened?
Uh-oh.
What'd you do?
I don't know what I did. Oh, are you back? I'm so sorry. We went away for a moment. I'm not sure why. We're here.
What was the typical day? Yeah. What was the typical day like, Linda? Was there such a thing as a typical day?
Well, you know, we were always, at least when I worked at Florida Ranger Station, we were always busy. And so whatever the assistant fire management officer was pretty much in charge of our daily tasks. And we always had something to do. I mean, we were either working trail, building fence. We'd even pick up trash on the side of the road. I mean, whatever, cleaning campgrounds. There was never a dull moment in the sense that we always had something to do and there was always more to do, but you know, when the fire call comes in, everything went on hold, and that's what we were there for. But having all of these varied tasks taught me so many life skills that I still use today. I mean, I've learned vehicle maintenance and chainsaw. I still use a chainsaw. I mean, there's, and it was something that I didn't know. It wasn't common in every on every Forest Service crew. We were just very fortunate to have a supervisor that believed in keeping us busy around the district. Mm-hmm. We didn't just sit around and wait for a fire call. We were always doing something. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, and I remember one day just getting up and being told, we're doing helicopters today. And I'd never been on a helicopter, and I was like, okay. So we had very brief helicopter training, so how not get your head cut off, and so how you approach the helicopter and how you don't approach a helicopter. And so, you know, it was one of those things where, I guess this is what we're doing today, and it was quite an adventure, as you read, because we had a crazy pilot, and so... But yeah, it was fun. You never know what was going to happen.
So the call comes in, or somehow you learn fire. So what does everybody do when that you get that notice? What happens?
Well, okay, so you know it depends. You know, if it's on the district, you know, we all if we're out and about, and we often were, we'd all go back to the station and load up our fire packs, which contained all of our gear. These packs had extra clothes, water, food, fusees in case we had to build a backfire. So it was well stocked, and we grabbed our fire packs and we'd hop into the trucks, and we would, if we could drive there, we would drive there. If we had to fly there, we would drive down to the heliport and a helicopter would come pick us up. In some cases, we would end up going off the district and we would drive to Tucson to the airport. The Forest Service has their own terminal at the Tucson International Airport, and we would go there, wait for a plane to pick us up and other crews and fly us to wherever we needed to go. It always amazed me. It was like, hurry up and wait, you know, because we would tear off, you know, ready to go, all fired up, ready to, you know, tackle this fire. And then we'd sit in the terminal for 6 hours.
That had to be,
Then all your enthusiasm is shot and you're tired. And then, you know, and then you end up being up all night and then going right on the line the very next day. Mm-hmm. So it was not uncommon to work 16-hour shifts or more.
We're talking with Linda Strader, the author of Summers of Fire. And we're going to take a very quick break and show you one of the places that you can order this book, which is the Out West Shop, bookshop.org affiliate page. Stay tuned. We're going to be right back with Linda in just a moment. Stay tuned. Story is everything. Find a great one on Out West Shop's bookshop. Go to outwestshop.com, find books and CDs on the menu, choose Shop Out West on bookshop.org. Browse through featured authors on Rendezvous with a Writer. Explore curated book lists and our featured picks. Add in note cards, calendars, and jigsaw puzzles. One-stop shopping for great gifts. Use the search box to find thousands more titles. Make the switch. Your purchase supports us as independent booksellers. That's our story.
Welcome back to Rendezvous with a Writer, where readers and writers meet. Our special guest tonight is Linda Strader, talking about Summers of Fire.
Yeah.
You know, reading the book and talking, there was a lot of physical challenges, and you guys did a lot of heavy work, as I remember reading. Particularly that one, well, you had the chain gang and 90-pound
bags. 90-pound bags of cement. Well, it was really smart to probably do that, the chain. But, my gosh, Linda, I was exhausted just reading your description.
And my journal entry said exactly how I put it in the book. You know, I forgot the quantity, you know, like, you know, 200 bags, 90-pound bags of cement passed through my hands today. And that's all I said. And that's all I needed to remind me of what that was like.
Yeah. Was there any other, you know, is there a moment or two that really stands out to you that you'd want to share? Something that just you'll always remember from your experience?
Gosh, there's so many of them. I actually connected with someone on Facebook this week in a Facebook group called We Love Memoirs, and I was their featured author. So I had my book up and some photos from back in the day, and I had a firefighter from Australia say, "Oh my gosh, you know, I'm a firefighter here in Australia, and we have, you know, we're one of the most fire prone countries, you know, in the world." And he says, have you ever had to, I forgot how we worded it, but have you ever had to, what it said to me was jump out of a helicopter because it couldn't land. Uh-huh. And I have. and so I will never forget that, because we were heading up to a fire in the mountains.
She'll come back. I know Linda will be back in a moment. We see that we've lost her temporarily. She is calling in from Arizona, and she may be having a little bit of a technical challenge. Here she is. She's back. We lost you for just a moment, Linda, but we knew you'd be back.
I'm back.
You're back. So you were talking about jumping out of the helicopter and what that experience was like.
Are we still here?
Yep, you're here. You're back. We're.
Okay. Yeah, it quit on me. So we flew up to a fire in the mountains near where I live now, and it was so smoky the pilot couldn't land. So he told me that I was going to have to jump out, and I thought he was kidding. So he hovered. He says, "I'm going to get as close to the ground as I can, and you're going to have to step out onto the skid and jump off." And okay,
he said they didn't cover that in training, did they?
It wasn't far. It was it was probably 3 or 4 feet, but I couldn't see what I was jumping into. So it's
wow.
Was this the pilot that was in served in the war in Vietnam? You said you had a hotshot pilot or two there that flew those helicopters.
Yeah, from Vietnam. Was this the pilot that flew the Huey in Vietnam? I don't know. Can you hear us? Can you hear us, Linda?
I'm sorry, you're breaking up.
Yeah. Was this the pilot that had flown in Vietnam?
Yeah.
No. Well, from what I understand, most of them had, but that one that that's
And Linda, we just lost her again for a moment. I know she's going to be back, and I hope that you're listening to this and having a great time listening. The book is really worth the read. She is sharing her stories. It's fun to actually hear her share her stories. And I think Linda is back with us again. Welcome back, Linda. Can you hear us? Are we?
Yeah, I've got a terrible connection. Very unpredictable tonight.
Yeah, that does happen sometimes. Yeah. Everybody's internet is a little different. So I'm hoping that you can hear us okay. I know you made a reference to your journals, that you'd made an entry in the journal when you talked about the cement chain. How important were those journals to you as you began to put the book together?
Well, at first I was just doing it from memory. And as I started to get a little more serious about it, realizing that maybe I actually had a book and so I was going to have to get my act together, I got out the journals and started realizing, oh my goodness, that's not in sequence with, that didn't happen where I thought it did. And at first I didn't think it would matter, but then I realized, no, it matters because I was introducing people to the story that I hadn't met yet. So I thought, okay. So they became very important because they kept me, they kept me on a timeline. And there were so many little, I would write, just one sentence in my journal that would jog a whole bunch of memories.
Okay.
So they were very important because I have a good memory. And I didn't have, even though my journals were very lengthy, I mean, I wrote pages per day. I didn't need all that detail, really, because sometimes, like I said, one sentence would bring back all of the memories of that particular event.
Mm-hmm. Is there that sounds like a really good tip for a memoir writer. Do you have, from your experience of now writing the memoir, do you have a good tip or two to somebody who's considering writing a memoir?
Well, I would say that if you think you have a story, you really have to focus on it being a story. So a memoir should read like a novel. In other words, it needs to have a distinct beginning, middle, and end. So you can't just write down a whole bunch of stuff that happened to you. And the temptation is to do that. But then again, I also say, get it all down on type, just write and write everything you want to say, and then go back and you'll recognize a theme or not. You'll see holes where wait a minute, this doesn't work. And so it's easier to just dump it all out and get it on paper or, on the computer and then go back than to, I'm not very good at writing an outline and then following the outline. It's not very creative that way. Mm-hmm. And so I think, especially with memoir, if you just get it out and get it down and then go back and put it together mm-hmm. the way it needs to be.
You know, the people that I'm sure you changed some of the names to protect the innocent, so to speak, but the folks that you talked about in the memoir, how did they receive it? How did they felt they were portrayed?
Were you able?
I'm
to
sorry,
hear?
Jim. I didn't catch all. You mean family or people?
Family
in the book?
Or people?
Yeah. What did the people that you wrote about? What did they think when they read the book?
Well, the people, there were very few people. Most of the people that I worked with, I couldn't find, and several of them have passed away. The ones that I could find, I got permission from to use their names. If they didn't respond, I just changed their names. And they were all okay with that. Everybody has a different memory. I'm still in touch with the character Jody, which is not her real name. So she asked me to change her name. Yeah. And she loved her character. So, and family-wise, my older sister wasn't too thrilled about it. And it's just, she wanted me to change it to reflect what she thought I should say. And I said, well, I'm sorry, but it's my book, not yours. And so, and that comes up a lot with people who write a memoir. What do I do if my, and I said, well, you got to be true to yourself. And everybody has a different memory of what is true for them. Mm-hmm. And if you start listening to what everybody else has to say, it's not your story anymore. So I say don't worry about it. But then again, you have to be careful, make sure that you're not writing your memoir to particularly hurt someone, because that's not right either. Mm-hmm. It should be your story.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It should be your story.
Not a vengeance, a tool of vengeance. You don't want to do that.
Right. How did you find your publisher?
Oh, that was a journey. I started querying literary agents at first. I really wanted an agent. And so I went through the several websites that are free that I went through, and I taught myself how to write a query letter, how to write a book proposal. And every mm-hmm. query that was rejected just made me more tenacious of, okay, maybe it's the query letter, or maybe it's mm-hmm. the first chapter, and I just kept, and once in a while I would actually get feedback from an agent that would tell me, the first chapter just didn't grab me. I took that very seriously. Then how do I fix that? Mm-hmm. And so I was queried for almost 2 years, and the whole time I was continuing mm-hmm. to perfect the story. And I finally decided I had to change the beginning. It was very hard to do. Because you really love your writing and you don't want to fix things. But I just thought it's not starting where it should. And so I changed the beginning to where I start right in the middle of my first fire. And I started getting a lot of attention then. And I had agents ask for full manuscripts. And in the meantime, I also started looking at small presses, thinking that's the next step. If you can't get an agent, you pitch small publishers. And I had three offers from three small publishers. And the agents were still dragging their feet. And I decided, I've been at this for 2 years now. I'm done. And I took an offer. And out of the three, I picked the one that I wanted. And mm-hmm. And I'm glad mm-hmm. I did.
Mm-hmm. Good for you. Mm-hmm.
Who That's is your
what was it?
Yeah. Who is your publisher?
Bedazzled Ink Publishing.
Bedazzled Ink Publishing.
Bedazzled Ink Publishing mm-hmm. out of California.
Yeah, yeah. And I think they're the publisher of your second book as well.
They are.
Yeah, wonderful. We're going to take a very quick break, and we're going to hear a little bit about one of our sponsors, Out West Shop, and we'll be back.
Here at the Out West Shop, we're passionate about the American West. The truth and the myth. We're purveyors of fine Western goods. We We scout for unique and distinctive apparel, accessories, home decor, and general merchandise that are a reflection of the Western lifestyle. We hunt for unique artisans and craftsmen who are inspired to create decorative art you can wear based on their own love for the story of the West. We round it up and bring it to you. Check out OutWestShop.com when you need anything Western.
Welcome back to Rendezvous with the Writer with special guest tonight, Linda Strader. And we're talking about her book, Summer of Fires. You know, there's a TV show on that's very popular on CBS these days called Fire Country. Have you ever seen that thing?
I have not. And I've had, it's the same thing with the movie Only the Brave, which is about the catastrophic fire that killed the 19 hotshots in the Prescott area. A number of years ago. I can't watch this stuff. It's too personal. Also, it reminds me of a career that ended that I didn't want to end. And I'm also really, really picky about realism. It's like, are you serious? You know, kind of like that. It doesn't happen that way. But no, but I find that it's a little too, it just brings back bad memories. So I'd rather not do that. Mm-hmm. I have not, I'm in a Facebook group for wildland firefighters and it's discussed and that, you know, they're all just like, oh, you've got to be kidding me. You know, so it's TV, you know, it's sensationalized. My guess is, you know, it's a little over the top, mm-hmm. but that's what people like. So, mm-hmm. you know,
yeah, we don't know anything about firefighting, but
we just wonder how true it was.
Yeah. We watch it because it comes before Blue Bloods, which we are fans of Blue Bloods, so we kind of watch Fire Country, and it doesn't do anything for me. The storylines and the characters are I can't say that I'm really engaged, but I always think about, is this the way it really? Do they have good consultants? Is this really the way it is? Is this what they should be doing right now?
Let's ask Linda.
Yeah. Yeah. Chances are, you know, it's probably a little over the top, you know, and you know, yeah, that's what sells. You know,
yeah. So. Well, and there's certainly there's a fire or there's an emergency kind of situation, but a lot of it is the relationships between the people on the crew, and it's you know, it's like it's not an evening soap opera, but it's kind, you know, it's the drama that goes on also between team, you know, team members.
And, oh yeah, no, yeah, that's real. I mean,
that's real.
Yeah, because it does happen. I mean, you know, and I have to say something about that job, and that's that, you know, it's really unlike most jobs because you're often with your crew members 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for weeks. And there aren't a whole lot of jobs where you're put into that kind of a situation. Mm-hmm. And so you get to know people really well, probably better than you want to.
For sure.
And, you know, and you can get on each other's nerves, you know, and all that. But then, you know, but also, you know, close relationships develop. You know, certainly there's a certain level of camaraderie. There's definitely, you know, love gets in the way. So it really, it's different. I mean, I've been in jobs where I've worked long hours with my office mates, you know, for a big project. Still, it's nothing like having your life in danger. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you're up and you're, you know, you're in a situation where you could die and you're working together, like I say, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for weeks. Mm-hmm. That's a whole different level.
Mm-hmm. And you're
getting to know somebody.
You're seeing each other, especially when you're actually combating fighting the fire. You see each other at your physical best in some ways, but not so in others. You can't be thinking about what's my hair look like and do I have, you know, dirt on my face and how many days since I've had a shower and, you know, all of those things that can play into a corporate team experience isn't anything like what you all on the front line what you're going through as you go about your, you know, your work day.
Yeah. You know, it's like, you know, I won't say all manners go out the window, but it does. It is.
Yeah.
It's different. I mean, I can remember, I mean, I still had a certain level of modesty, you know, and if to get a good night's sleep, I certainly tried to take off some of my fire clothes because I couldn't get comfortable in the sleeping bag with the full gear on. But I tried to do it inside the sleeping bag. So, you know, I'm inside there trying not to expose any skin. And then I'm thinking, who cares? Everybody's so darn tired. And I'm so worried about showing the shoulder, you know, and I realized this is ridiculous, but I would do it anyway.
Do you want to ask about her landscape architect work? And
about what?
We were curious about how some of the skills that you learned have translated into your landscape architect, if they have translated into your landscape architect work.
Oh gosh. It's so completely different. I can't even compare the two jobs. I mean, I'm very independent and as I get older, I finally decide I quit caring what people think of what I think. You know, I tell somebody, you know, that's a terrible idea. I wouldn't do that if I was you. So, but you know, it's the confidence that I get, I still get a great deal of satisfaction out of, you know, finishing a project, whether I'm finishing a project when I was working for the Forest Service, whether it was simple as, you know, trail maintenance and seeing the trail completed and it looks really nice, to you know, finishing a project and doing a walkthrough with the client and it all turned out the way I envisioned. So there's still a great deal of satisfaction that I get out of my work of making sure that I do the best that I can do. And I've always tried to do the best that I can do in both jobs.
Yeah, you did. I think you remade a lot of trails in your job as in the Forest Service. I remember reading about, you know, clearing trails and cleaning them up, and as far as being able to walk on them and get through them, not necessarily picking up Dixie cups or something like that, but which I know you did too.
Well, your love for the outdoors obviously is has translated into the work that you chose for the latter part of your career. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yes, absolutely. And you know, with landscape architecture, I mean, a lot of it's, you know, it's I'm on the computer. I do most of my design work on the computer, which is different. But, you know, I still have to have my nature fixed. I still go hiking in the same mountains where I fought fires for 3 years.
Sure.
I still have to have that.
You have a new book out called Uprooted, A New Life in the Arizona Sun. And congratulations on your second book.
Oh, thank you.
You want to tell us a little bit about this and how it came to be?
Well, so after I very reluctantly gave the final manuscript to my publisher with the final edits and they were going to go do their thing, I was a lost soul not having a writing project. And I thought, gosh, you know, I got to have something to work on. So I got out my journals and this time I dug up the ones from 1972 and on and realized I got totally engrossed thinking there's another story in here. And I thought, okay, so this time I'm going to be more organized. I am going to. So what I did was I outlined all of my journal entries by year, and then I started writing and I would refer to those outlines and thinking that that book would be easier to put together, and it was not. it's still hard work, and it was also very difficult living through some of those times again. So this is where I'm, you know, taken away from my home in Syracuse in my senior year of high school and moved to a small town of 12,000. And not welcome, you know, who wants to make friends in their senior year of high school? So I was, I couldn't find any friends. I didn't really care. I just wanted to go back to Syracuse. So, but at the same time, I was also trying to figure out, so what the heck am I going to do with my life? And so this book is more focused on, I, you know, they say coming of age is usually like, you know, your adolescent to teens, but I think to me, coming of age is more of you're a teen and you become a young adult, because that is a huge change in the way you see the world and figure out what you want to do and who you want to be and how you're going to, you know, how you're going to make your way of life. And that's what Uprooted is more about, those challenges, but how I stumble onto working for the Forest Service as a firefighter, which was not my plan, but it just, it fell into my lap and there it is. You know,
so. Mm-hmm. So Linda, tell us, how can people find you, follow you? How, where can they find their books and all of that? Give us that good stuff.
Okay. Well, so I have, so I mean, my book is available on Amazon, Barnes and Noble, bookshop.org. And it's also, I have a blog which has, I've written many articles on the craft of writing memoir and also articles about women first, you know, women first in their field or in accomplishing various feats. And it's called summersoffirebook.blogspot.com.
Yeah.
And I have photos back in the day and I try to keep it up to date. I just hit the 56,000 visits mark the other day.
Congratulations.
So, to my book on there as well. And I have a Facebook author page, which is Linda M. Strader, and it's landscape architect, artist, and author. In fact, if anybody just types my name in their browser, I've done so many podcast interviews, and I've been on TV. I've had a PBS special done about me. It's just a really long list. So. It's been like a journey.
Yeah, we're honored that you chose to come on and be with us. My goodness.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I'm honored that you asked. This is great fun. They're always so much fun.
Yeah. Well, don't go
great
away.
Questions.
Well, we're so happy to have had the time, and we really enjoyed reading the books. And to our listeners out there, you will want to get one, if not both of these books. I know, especially for summer reading, what a great book with a summers in the title.
Yeah, there we go.
Thank you for being with us. Just hold on. We're going to go ahead now and just kind of wrap up the show. So let's see. Join us next week, when our guest is author Vince Pinkerton. He's written two books, The Devil Plays Six Strings. We're going to start reading these tonight. And The Devil and the Dance Hall Girl. We're very excited about Vince joining us next week. Let's see. You have a couple of quotes.
We have a couple of quotes. I have a seriousness. Both of them are serious, but one is more serious, it seems, than the other. From Teddy Roosevelt. As quoted in the book, The Big Burn by Timothy Egan. Teddy says, of all the foes which attack the woodlands of North America, no other is so terrible as fire. And the other quote, which is quite famous, is from Smokey the Bear. Only you can prevent forest fires.
We thank you so much for being with us tonight. And we thank Linda Strader for joining us. And we thank Sam Hassan of LA Talk Radio, Alex Dormont, and the Hot Texas Swing Band. And we look forward to joining with you again next week.
Next week.
Until then.
Remember, it's always a great day out west.
listening to Rendezvous with the Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.